We've talked throughout this course on the healing value of touch. And the more that I learn, actually I just did a literature search on massages. I think there was 140 references in the last 3 years in the Medline on touch. And Dr. Fields at the University of Miami is really kind of leading this charge. She's a nurse in a prenatal intensive care unit, or was. She's now, I think, a professor. Does anybody know Dr. Fields? And so she did the original study years ago, taking these preemies, massaging them for a few minutes, and showing that they gained weight faster and they were able to be discharged from the neonatal intensive care unit sooner. Subsequently, she's done more studies in a whole range of conditions. So babies who are coming from cocaine-addicted moms do much better if they're massaged regularly in the first few days after birth. Babies coming from moms who have HIV infection seem to do much better than others. There's really a tremendous amount of literature now on the healing value of massage. You can show changes in immune function within just a few minutes, increases in natural killer cell activity, changes in the ratio of the T cell subsets. You can show that if you take people who are in a high-stress job, like air traffic controllers, where their blood pressure is high and their stress hormones are high, and you give them 15-minute breaks where you just have someone gently massaging their shoulders, their blood pressure comes down, their stress hormones come down, and their performance substantially is enhanced for the rest of the day because they're not functioning from that state of fight or flight all the time. So it's really good to be touched and to touch other people. This researcher, I think he was an anthropologist, wanted to see how often people touched each other. And so he sat around, it was a great job, I wish I could get a grant like this, sat around in cafes around the world watching, and in Latin America, people touched each other a lot. In fact, they don't stop touching each other. You can walk down the streets of Bogota or any place in Venezuela, and you know, women will be walking arm in arm with women, men will be walking. It's just that constant touching is considered part of the culture. In the United States, it turns out that people only really touch each other twice. They shake hands usually when they meet, then they don't touch at all during the time that they're together, and then they may shake hands again when they leave. If you go to England, it turns out people never touch each other, which is why the population in Great Britain seems to be steadily falling. You know, we have all this ambivalence about touch because we're concerned about touch leading to sexuality. But, you know, if we really touched people as if they were our family members, our children, our brothers, our sisters, it would really do a lot to create that connectedness. When people are really in that state of vata aggravation, it's as if you forget you have a body. You know, your mind is just taking over everything. And so that grounding effect of a massage is really a great way to put things back into perspective. So it certainly pacifies vata, improves circulation. You can see when you're feeling kind of drowsy, it may actually put you to sleep for a few minutes, but it's almost like a very deep meditation, and you'll come out of it feeling very refreshed. It loosens toxins, and we'll talk about the whole Panchakarma process later today. It softens the skin, improves digestion, and increasingly now there's really good data to show that it has lasting benefits on our immune system. Now, of course, in Ayurveda, we've classified everything in terms of Vata Pitta Kapha, including the oils that you can use for a massage. In general, if you're a Vata type, the massage should be fairly gentle, and the oil that you want to use should be warm and rich. So the best massage oil for people with Vata is sesame. Sesame is probably the best for everybody, but sesame is a little bit heating. So people who have a pitta constitution sometimes get a little bit overheated by the sesame, which is expressed as some irritation on the skin. But Vatas generally do very well with sesame oil. Almond is a second excellent oil for Vatas. Pittas do better with a cooling oil, and the ones that are said to be cooling in Ayurveda are coconut, olive, and sunflower. So if you're a strong pitta, you can do a massage using what's considered to be a cooling oil. Kaphas in general, you're a little concerned about adding all that oil because they're already kapha, and oil is unctuous and heavy. But Kaphas do best with either heating oils or lighter oils. So the heating oils are, again, are sesame, mustard seed oil is actually a good oil for people who are kapha types. Or the very light oils, like safflower is said to be a lighter oil. Kaphas also do well with the dry massage, which stimulates the circulation but doesn't add that amount of oil. And then you can use aromas to add that additional level of sensory stimulation. Vatas, again, do best with aromas that are calming, warm, heavier. The most pacifying vata aroma is probably vanilla. It just has that warm, sweet heaviness to it. But most of the floral and fruity fragrances are vata pacifying, except for jasmine, which is a little bit cooling and more kind of elevating. Pittas do very well with, again, the floral, sweet floral fragrances. Particularly jasmine is very good for pittas. Sandalwood is very good for pittas. Rose is very good for pittas. And then kaphas do best with kind of the more spicy fragrances. So cinnamon, eucalyptus, sage, basil, slightly more medicinal or herby smells are good for kaphas. But more importantly than anything is that you choose something that you like. In Ayurveda, one of the most important things for good general health is to perform a daily massage on yourself. And it's recommended that you do this before you take your bath or your shower. So it's a nice ritual. It can take 10, 15 minutes if you have the time. It can take about 10 or 15 seconds if you don't. It's really a great thing to add to your day. What you want to do is you get the oil that you're going to be using and get one of these little plastic squeegee bottles with the flip tops on it so you don't have the glass bottle in your bathroom. And then just heat it up under the hot running water or fill up your sink partway with hot water. Get it so it's a little bit warmer than room temperature. It's good to lay yourself out a towel that you consider to be your abhyanga. Abhyanga is the Sanskrit word for self-massage, or actually it's for applying oil. So use one towel because it does tend to saturate the towel and then you don't have all your towels smelling like sesame oil. But find one towel and then you heat up the oil and you just use a little bit of it. You're not going to be covering yourself with this type of a massage. It's just enough to get the skin lubricated with the oil. So let's do it together because it's actually fun and it'll wake us up. So we're pretending that we have this oil. Put a little bit of oil, and then you'll start by just as if you're shampooing your head. So using mainly the flat parts of your hand, a little bit of your fingers, just rub it through your scalp. Then move to your forehead and just move the oil into your forehead. Then the rest of your face. And then spend some extra time on your ears. And Ayurveda describes these points known as marma points, which are these junction points between consciousness and matter. And there are a lot of them in the ear. In fact, most of the acupuncture points are actually derived from these marma points. Spend a little time on your neck and the back of your neck. And then over your chest, gently rub in circular motions over your chest. Up and down over the sternum. And then circular over the abdomen. It's a great thing to do when your children have tummy aches. Just get a little bit of warm oil and just rub their belly in a clockwise direction. Then, as best as you can, go up and down over your spine. This is when it really helps to have a partner. Okay. Then, over the limbs, you want to make circular motions over the joints and then back and forth motions over the long bones. Circular over the elbow, back and forth over the forearm, circular over the wrist, and then spend some time on your hands, going through your palms and your fingers. Okay. And then same thing with your other side, circular over the shoulder, back and forth over the upper arm, circular over the elbow, back and forth over the forearm, circular over the wrist, and then spend some time on your palms, your fingers. And then the same thing with the, with your legs. So it's circular over the hips, back and forth over the upper leg, circular over the knee, back and forth over the lower leg, circular over the ankle. And then I would encourage you to take off your shoes and spend a little time on your feet. Now, the recommended procedure for the sole of the foot is this kind of back and forth motion. So it's back and forth motion. And then spend extra time on the toes and between the toes. Okay. And then the same thing on the other side. Circular over the hip, back and forth over the leg, circular over the knee, back and forth over the foreleg, circular over the ankle, and spend some time on the soles of your foot and your toes. Even moving fairly slowly, it takes less than 5 minutes. If you can leave the oil on, it's the best because it'll absorb quickly into the skin, provides a protective layer, it pacifies vata. So then when you take your shower, use some light soap, like a glycerin soap, like a Neutrogena or some other type of mild soap, and then enjoy your day. Now, if you don't even have time for that, then because the head and the feet are the most important in terms of pacifying the vata, then it's recommended that you at least do the scalp massage, ears, face, and your feet. So you can really do that in 1 minute. So there's no excuse to not do a daily oil massage. I really would encourage you to do it today or tomorrow morning before you take your shower. Just try it once with full oil and just see how you feel. It really makes a difference. It's great to do as a family on a Sunday morning where everyone takes does a massage together. And it's a great ritual that really will start your day off great. Now, if you have trouble sleeping, you can do this before bed. So the recommended procedure is first make yourself a nice warm bath, and you can put in some vata pacifying herbs into the bath as well, or vata pacifying aromas. Then do a nice, slow, gentle massage, take a warm bath, then either drink a cup of vata pacifying tea or make yourself a cup of warm milk with some cardamom and nutmeg in it, and then get into bed. And you'll see that this whole procedure, quieting down the vata through the touch, through the warm bath, through the milk, all that will just get you to sleep. Everyone want to take a nap right now just thinking about it? Okay. So, touch often, touch sensitively. It's what connects us. Use it regularly. You'll see it really makes a difference. It's one of the most nurturing things we can do.
This last session, I thought we'll look at the next frontier as far as the evolution of consciousness-based medicine is concerned, and look at what's beyond that frontier as well. So in this session, I intend to talk about two specific things. The first is human aging, biological aging, as we are beginning to understand it. And then I also want to talk about what happens as we begin to unfold the full potential of consciousness. And is there a map for looking at that? So I want to discuss both those things. And they're, in a sense, interrelated. Human aging, unlike the aging of other animals, is not a fixed thing. The aging of animals is very predictable, and there are all kinds of theories about what results, why does a tortoise live 180 years and aardvark 23 years and frog 16 years, but none of these theories really are fully satisfying because the fact still remains that the aging of animals is very fixed. And in humans, the aging response is extremely fluid. Human aging accelerates for sure when you're under stress. Human aging accelerates when somebody has a prolonged period of grief or bereavement. There are instances of people biologically aging in a very short time. Human aging is known to slow down if you're in love, for example. But the most interesting thing about human aging is that it is also reversible biologically. And I want to talk about that a little bit in a few moments. If you look at the history of how humans have aged in our civilization, they've come across some very interesting statistics. In the Roman Empire, the average age of a human being was 28 years. So when Caesar died at the age of 31 or 32, he was a really old man. In the early part of this century, the average age in the United States was 49 years. And when the founding fathers of this country wrote the Constitution, they were old people in their mid-30s. And today, the average age in the United States, in Japan, in Western Europe, and also the developing nations of the world, the average age is about close to 80, a little longer for women than for men. What is even more remarkable is that the number of people growing older and at the same time maintaining biological youth is increasing. The fastest growing segment of the American population today is over the age of 90. The fastest rate of growth in the population is people over the age of 90. So definitely there's something happening in society where expectations of what happens with aging are changing. And that's really a very important thing to know. Expectations influence outcome. So the first studies on human biological age were done by a physician from the Massachusetts General Hospital, a physician called Alexander Leaf. He was a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. And towards the end of his career, he actually decided to go all over the world to look at how people aged in different parts of the world. And he found that there were certain parts of the world where there were people who were living to extraordinarily old ages. So amongst these were the state of Georgia in Russia, in the Soviet Union at that time, where he found a lot of centenarians. He discovered a lot of people in the age group of 105 to 115. And he was very puzzled by this group of people in Abkhazia and in Georgia, because a lot of them were actually smokers at the age of 104, 105. They would work in the fields at the age of 90, 100, horseback riding, swimming in ice-cold streams, in snowy mountains, etc. He also found the same phenomenon in certain parts of Afghanistan, and also found the same phenomenon in certain parts of the Hindu Kush Mountains. And, of course, in Mexico, there's a group of Indians known as the Tarahumara Indians that not only age in a completely different way, but there is a tradition amongst the Tarahumara Indians of marathon running. And their collective belief system is that as you grow older, you become better at running. So the 60-year-olds are faster runners and have more endurance than the 20-year-olds. That's part of their tradition. In fact, that's how they send messages, or used to send messages, from one Indian chief to another. Expectation influences outcome. Dr. Leaf wanted to find the common ingredient in all these different population groups. And he could not find anything that was common in their diet. For example, the diet of people in Alaska, by our standards, is extremely unhealthy, of the Indians in Alaska. Most of the time they eat whale blubber. And yet, if you put them on a vegetarian diet, then their cholesterol goes up, they get rotten teeth and heart attacks. Because they have adapted to their environment over millennia. So he couldn't find a common factor in their diet. He couldn't find a common factor in the climate. He couldn't find a common factor in anything except one thing. And that was the collective belief system of these people. In Abkhazia, for example, the collective belief system is that as you grow older, you get better. That as you grow elder, you become wiser. That as you grow older, you become more glamorous. So, in fact, one of the problems Dr. Leaf had when he was doing his studies was that he never really knew how old these people were, because every time he asked them their age, they exaggerated it. Because it was fashionable to be older. So they would always exaggerate it, he says, which is quite the reverse of what people do in other parts of the world. His thesis, therefore, was that the collective belief system, or the collective consciousness, if you will, influences the individual expectation. And Nietzsche once said, even though we think that we think, even though we believe that we are thinking all the time, most of the time we are being thought by the collective mind. Our individual thoughts are context bound. They come out not randomly, but out of a context of cultural expectations and social expectations, our racial history, our religious indoctrination, our whole worldview influences every single thought that you have. And if your collective expectation, therefore, is that by age 65 we have to retire, and then shortly after that we have to go to Florida, and shortly after that we have to languish in a nursing home, then that will become a self-fulfilling prophecy. To alter the epidemiology of aging, which has influenced the aging on a collective level, then you have to really begin to educate people that human aging is extremely flexible, and that there are examples of people who are achieving an advanced degree of chronological age, but at the same time maintaining a youthful biological age, then there must be a mechanism for it. And if there is a mechanism for it, then we can all learn about it. George Bernard Shaw, who is a great example actually of graceful aging, throughout history there have been people like that. Bernard Shaw, Tolstoy, Leonardo da Vinci, Michelangelo, Picasso made great contributions to humanity in their 8th and 9th decades. So one of his famous quotes is, George Bernard Shaw says, "Youth, oh what a pity to waste it on the young." So, there is now, with what we know about aging, the first time the ability to create a situation where you have both the wisdom of experience as well as the biology of youth. Because human aging is definitely flexible, fluid enough even to be reversible. I think we want to, when defining aging, we want to be familiar with certain terms. There is chronological age, which is the age on your birth certificate and your social security card. There is psychological age, which is, of course, how young or old you feel psychologically. There are ways to measure that. There is biological age, which is if somebody knew, had no idea about how old you were, but they were to do certain tests, what would they say? How old you are? Because you can be emotionally and spiritually and physically burnt out, and you can be chronologically 25, but you can have a biological age of an old man. On the other hand, you can be chronologically 60 or 70, and you can have the biological age of a 25-year-old. So don't confuse chronological age with biological age. And obviously, biological age is the more important marker of aging. It tells you exactly how your physiology is performing. And then, of course, there's this whole realm of spiritual age, which is essentially timeless. It's eternal. So let's look at how scientists actually would measure somebody's biological age. These are the 10 biomarkers of aging. These are the 10 biomarkers of aging. And now we can add a few more to this. Let's go over these first, and then I'll tell you what the others are. So the first way to measure somebody's age is to measure their bone density. As people grow older, their bones become thinner, and a condition starts called osteoporosis. And in fact, there are technologies such as X-ray densitometry through which you can accurately predict a person's biological age just by measuring their bone density. The second measure of biological age is body temperature regulation. How flexible is their ability to regulate their body temperature? The body temperature usually remains within a very narrow range, from 98.4 degrees to about 99 in that range. And how adaptable is that ability to environment? So older people usually get heat stroke very easily because their body temperature regulation ability is not as good. So body temperature regulation is a good marker for biological aging. Basal metabolic rate, which means the metabolic rate when you're not doing anything, at rest. And as people grow older, their metabolic rate starts to decrease. Young people have a higher metabolic rate. So, of course, if you measured lots of people's basal metabolic rate, you might get different metabolic rates depending on their thyroid activity, depending on whether they are vata or pitta or kapha. We're not talking about that. We're talking about their basal metabolic rate at different ages. So whatever their basal metabolic rate is, as people grow older, it starts to fall. Sugar tolerance, which means how easily do you metabolize sugar? If you metabolize sugar very fast, that's usually a sign of youthfulness. As people grow older, they get insulin deficiency, insulin resistance. There are some changes in the secretion of growth hormone. In fact, growth hormone is decreased as people grow older. So, and growth hormone happens to be an insulin antagonist. And for a variety of complex reasons, what happens is, as people grow older, they don't metabolize carbohydrate as well. They don't metabolize sugar as well, and they get what is called sugar intolerance, and of course, more likely to get type 2 diabetes as well. So that's another. You can do a glucose tolerance test, which is inject sugar and watch it over several hours, and you can also predict or calculate biological age. Strength of muscles. As people grow older, the muscle's strength gets weaker. As fat content in the body, people grow older, the relationship of fat to muscle, the ratio of fat to muscle also decreases. Aerobic capacity, which is your ability to utilize oxygen, that decreases as people grow old. Cholesterol HDL ratios, so you know that there are two kinds of cholesterol, HDL, high density lipoprotein, and low density lipoprotein. So low LDL, the low density lipoprotein, is the so-called bad cholesterol, and HDL is the so-called good cholesterol. As people grow older, the HDL cholesterol ratio starts to go down, which means HDL starts to decrease and the bad cholesterol starts to go up. Muscle mass, which is separate from muscle strength, blood pressure. Systolic blood pressure, in fact, increases by about 10 points for every decade of life after 50. So these are very standard, well-known biomarkers of the aging process. And there are three more I should mention. Actually, there are several more, but a few that are important. Vision. As people grow older, their vision gets worse. Sex hormone levels, particularly a precursor of testosterone, the male hormone, and the female hormone estrogen, the precursor that's called DHEA sulfate, which is short for dehydroepiandrosterone sulfate. It's an adrenal steroid that is metabolized into testosterone. And as people grow older, their DHEA levels start to fall. Younger people, the DHEA levels are higher. So vision, sex hormones levels, sexual activity as well, DHEA levels, and other things can be also measured. Things like immune function. Immune function starts to fall as people grow older. And there are some very easy non-invasive things to do that can measure immune function. You can measure IgA levels in the saliva. IgA is a secretory immunoglobulin, part of the immune system. Skin sickness decreases. And of course, what people notice most is wrinkles, which is a result of decreasing skin thickness and a change in the elasticity or collagen in the skin. These are the standard biomarkers of aging. And I got interested in looking at the literature on this and actually pursuing some research on this shortly after my own personal interest in meditation in the 1980s. But before I get into that, in the 1980s, about 1986 I think it was, there was a very interesting study that was published by Ellen Langer from Harvard University. Ellen Langer is a psychologist at Harvard, and she's actually a full professor now of psychology at Harvard University. At that time she was a young scientist, but she made headlines. She also wrote a book called Mindfulness at that time, and she had been influenced by Dr. Alexander Leaf's studies in Abkhazia and Russia. And in the 80s, she did an experiment that was published in many journals and actually caught a lot of attention. And she called this a time experiment. And what she did was, she advertised in the Boston Globe that she wanted 100 participants to participate in a time experiment. And she got the 100 participants. They were all over the age of 80. Every single volunteer was over the age of 80. She put them in a bus and she took them to a monastery about 25 miles outside of Boston. And in that monastery, she created an environment from the 1950s. So Elvis Presley, rock and roll music, Chevy Impalas parked outside, Alfred Hitchcock movies, Walter Cronkite reading the news. He looked young and had pimples on his face. And she said to them, be as you were in the 50s. In fact, they wore name tags, but along with the name tags, they had photographs of themselves from 30 years previously. And they were asked to identify themselves not by looking at each other first, but by looking at the photograph from 30 years ago. So that was their method of identifying each other. And then she followed them for only 3 weeks. And guess what? Every single biomarker that she measured over 3 weeks had reversed. Every single biomarker that she measured had reversed. And not just a little, but significantly. In 3 weeks by 3 years, which means that's a huge reversal in the biomarkers of aging in a short period of time. She brought them back to Boston And of course, as soon as they came back to Boston, they started going back in the other direction. And the reason I mention this study, and it fascinates me, is not because I think we should all go to a monastery and pretend we're living in the 50s, but because it raises a very crucial, really crucial question. And that question is, what is reality? What is reality? And perhaps what we call everyday reality is nothing other than a socially programmed hypnosis in which we're all collectively caught up. What we call everyday reality is a socially programmed hypnosis. And from time to time, people have broken out of that socially programmed hypnosis. It's been a motley collection of sages and psychotics and geniuses. Sometimes go to a psychiatric ward, as I've done through my training. Go to a psychiatric ward, and I'm not joking, and you'll see very different expressions of biological age depending on the kind of psychosis that people have. Because psychosis is a reality. It just happens to be an isolated reality and not part of the collective reality. If we are all having a collective psychosis, then we assume it's reality. It happened in Germany when the Holocaust took place. A whole collective psyche became psychotic, but nobody thought, at least while in it, that there was anything abnormal about it. So there's an interesting thing about these altered states of consciousness. In medical school, when we learned about neurosis, we were told a neurotic is a person who builds castles in the air, and a psychotic is one who lives in them. And maybe, it's an important thing to ask ourselves, are we part of a psychosis of the collective mind? That what we call normal is the psychopathology of the average, which we take for granted? Really, unless we ask ourselves that, we will not be breaking out of the hypnosis of our own conditioning. And that's the whole goal of everything you've learned this week, is to start a process of self-awareness which allows us to become independent of the collective mind, and ultimately to reach a critical mass of self-awareness so the collective mind itself transforms. Because unless the collective mind transforms, our individual thoughts being context-bound, we are not going to really have a change, a real dramatic change in our biological function. Because we are influenced by that. And Ayurveda, in fact, in Vedic science, the history of humanity is divided into four distinct yugas or eons of time. And there are some references to that in the biblical literature as well. So a span of time where the critical mass is more or less enlightened. And if the critical mass is more or less enlightened, then everybody is living for 1,000 years. It's called Satyug in Vedic literature. And the extreme opposite of that is where the critical mass is in the stage of extreme ignorance. And it's presumably what we're in now. And where the average lifespan is less than 100. And then there are phases in between. And the pendulum kind of swings between one eon of time, another eon of time. And there are references to that in biblical literature as well. From a purely scientific perspective, though, I think one can say that our consciousness, because it transforms itself into our biology, is the critical element in the human aging process. Now, having said that, let's go over these biomarkers. I mentioned to you Ellen Langer's study. Well, there was another study in the 1980s, which was not a psychological intervention at all. And this study was from Tufts University. And this study actually took people between the ages of 84 and 96. So the youngest person in the Tufts University study was 84, and the oldest was 96. They started with 84-year-old people, 84 years young people, I should say. And they started with weight training, slowly, and then introduced aerobic exercise. And in 6 months of first very gradual progressive increase in exercise, physical exercise, both aerobics and weight training, in 6 months, these people between the ages of 84 and 96, they were biologically, as measured by these biomarkers in their 50s and 60s. They could lift more weight, they had more stamina, they had more mental alertness, they had more creativity, they had more vitality, they had more enthusiasm for life than people in their 50s and 60s. Remarkable study, absolutely. So since then, of course, there's the Cooper Institute in the South, and there's the Tufts University group. There are many studies going on now on how far can you carry this. I mean, if you start earlier, would it have more dramatic effects? Intuitively, it makes sense. Physical activity, both weight training, and what weight training does is it increases your basal metabolic rate, it increases your aerobic capacity. These are direct effects of exercise and weight training. It increases bone density, it increases muscle mass, it increases strength of muscles, so there are direct effects of all of this, and it increases DHEA levels as well by itself. So that was another very remarkable piece of data. The third piece of data came also in the 1980s, and this was on a group of people practicing meditation. It was done by Keith Wallace, who is a PhD, and in fact did the first study on the physiology of meditation in 1970. He was associated and has been associated with Maharishi, who brought, Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, brought meditation to the West, literally in a huge way, starting in the 60s. So Keith Wallace and Benson, who is a Harvard physician, did this landmark study in 1970, which was published in the journal Science. And it was on the physiology of meditation, where he described meditation. But subsequently, they did a study where they took meditators, people who'd been practicing meditation twice a day regularly for 5 years, and compared them with people in the control population who were not meditating. And at 5 years, the difference in biological age in the same chronological group was 12 years. So people who had been meditating regularly for 5 years had a biological age 12 years younger than their chronological age. You say, how is that possible? Well, that is possible because of all the metabolic effects of the meditative process, and particularly the metabolic effect on hormones like adrenaline and cortisol, prolactin, growth hormone, all these hormones are influenced by meditation. In the mid-80s, I got involved in a study with Dr. Glaser, who used to be a colleague of mine. What we did, we started measuring DHEA levels in people who regularly practice meditation. DHEA is the adrenal steroid, that's the precursor of the male and female hormones. And we followed people for 5 years, regular meditation. We found that with every year there was an incremental increase in DHEA in the people who were meditating, and there was a corresponding decrease in people who were not. So meditation directly affects DHEA levels in your body, DHEA being an anti-aging hormone. There are other studies that show that growth hormone and growth factors really influence how people age. So in youth, when we are children, we have huge spurts of growth hormone. It's the hormone that's responsible for growth. But adults also secrete growth hormone. And in adults, the function of growth hormone is that it's an anabolic hormone. It takes all forms of energy and stores them in your system. And as people grow older, first of all, the surges of growth hormone decrease, but also growth hormone levels also decrease. So about 1985 or so, there was a study in the New England Journal of Medicine, and this study was about people all in their 80s who were actually given growth hormone injections, human growth hormone, which is now easily available and can be synthesized through biotechnology. So these people were all given growth hormone injections for a period of about 6 months. And the New England Journal of Medicine was a leading article on the biological reversibility of the human aging process with the administration of growth hormone. And lots of things were measured, including in this case wrinkles. So you have these pictures of people who are in the 80s, and then you look at them and they look like they're 40 or 50, and they keep getting the growth hormone injection and their face keeps changing. And so this became a very controversial study, because obviously people wanted to start using growth hormone, and the FDA had its own precautions about this because not much was known. And surely, as these people continued to receive growth hormone, they developed other problems. Acromegaly, which is an endocrine problem, they developed diabetes, they developed congestive heart failure, something called cardiomyopathy, which is a condition of the heart. They even had an increased incidence of cancer. So growth hormone therapy for its anti-aging effects was discarded in the United States. But if you are from Europe, then I can tell you that there are clinics today in Switzerland and in parts of France where people still go for growth hormone rejuvenative therapy, and it's given under controlled conditions. What's my opinion about that? I think it's highly dangerous. You can probably never predict what's going to happen if you give an excessive amount of growth hormone, and it's going to probably create monsters in the future if it is continued. But because of this data, we also got interested, and my colleagues and some of us who are interested in this started measuring growth factors and growth hormone after massage. And of course, growth hormone goes up very dramatically after a massage, in adults as well as in children. In children, of course, also it grows up. If you massage a baby every day, it'll grow twice as fast, given the same diet in the early formative years. Same diet, because of the secretion of growth factors and growth hormone. So I think massage has rejuvenative effects, undoubtedly, not only because of the secretion of growth hormone, but also because of the absorption of free radical scavengers, and especially if you use antioxidants in the massage oil, if you use herbal supplements in the massage oil, there's a huge amount of transdermal absorption which affects not only growth hormone levels but the antioxidant effects. So therefore, there's another strategy to aging, anti-aging, and that is nutritional supplements. What are the nutritional supplements that definitely alter biological markers of aging? Antioxidants. So the research is on antioxidants. So vitamin C, A, E are antioxidants. And they definitely affect the biomarkers of aging. Now, we started to look at the herbal supplements in the Vedic, Ayurvedic literature. And of all of those, the one that's supposed to be the most effective is Amlaki, the Indian gooseberry, Embelia myrabolum. This is the most powerful antioxidant known, more than any vitamin C that you can take, because it comes in a very special way, packaged by Mother Nature. The receptors in the body recognize it, and the way it's made is with ghee, which is clarified butter. And you would say, my God, clarified butter, what's that going to do to my cholesterol? Well, first of all, there's very little of it. Secondly, it turns out that our receptors that bind to these antioxidants in the body are lipid receptors, which means they're made of little molecules of fat. So actually, the clarified butter, which is used to prepare this biochavan, it helps the absorption of this nutrient. There are many good studies worldwide on the effects of this antioxidant effect anti-carcinogenic effects, anti-arthritic effects, and basically rejuvenative effects. So if I was to summarize all the strategies for aging, I would say they are as follows, the ones that I mentioned. Change your expectation about aging. Get enough exercise to really make a difference in your muscle mass, in your muscle strength, in your bone density. And you have to go about doing that gradually, but really put attention on increasing muscle mass, bone density, and muscle strength. Everything else will be taken care of if you do that. Third, meditate every day, regularly, consistently. Once a day is not good enough. It's like, you know, taking one aspirin, it doesn't get rid of the headache. You have to take two. And you don't need to take three, you might get an ulcer. So you don't need to meditate more than twice a day also. You don't want to feel like a zombie. Just the right dose. And fourth, take nutritional supplements, either herbal or other antioxidants. Now, recently there's a whole body of literature on DHEA as a supplement. And there's a whole body of literature that's saying that DHEA, in fact, alters biological aging. There's some literature that is emerging on melatonin. And all I can say to you is it looks good. But I can't say that the scientific data at the moment says definitely this is going to work. But subsequently, they did a study where they took meditators, people who'd been practicing meditation twice a day regularly for 5 years, and compared them with people in the control population who were not meditating. And at 5 years, the difference in biological age in the same chronological group was 12 years. So people who'd been meditating regularly for 5 years had a biological age 12 years younger than their chronological age. You say, how is that possible? Well, that is possible because of all the metabolic effects of the meditative process, and particularly the metabolic effects on hormones like adrenaline and cortisol, prolactin, growth hormone. All these hormones are influenced by meditation. In the mid-80s, I got involved in a study with Dr. Glaser, who used to be a colleague of mine. What we did, we started measuring DHEA levels in people who regularly practice meditation. DHEA is the adrenal steroid. That's the precursor of the male and female hormones. And we followed people for 5 years, regular meditation. We found that with every year there was an incremental increase in DHEA, in the people who were meditating, and there was a corresponding decrease in people who were not. So meditation directly affects DHEA levels in your body, DHEA being an anti-aging hormone. There are other studies that show that growth hormone and growth factors really influence how people age. So in youth, when we are children, we have huge spurts of growth hormone. It's the hormone that's responsible for growth. But adults also secrete growth hormone. And in adults, the function of growth hormone is that it's an anabolic hormone. It takes all forms of energy and stores them in your system. And as people grow older, first of all, the surges of growth hormone decrease, but also growth hormone levels also decrease. So about 1985 or so, there was a study in the New England Journal of Medicine. And this study was about people all in their 80s, who were actually given growth hormone injections, human growth hormone, which is now easily available and can be synthesized through biotechnology. So these people were all given growth hormone injections for a period of about 6 months. And the New England Journal of Medicine was a leading article on the biological reversibility of the human aging process with the administration of growth hormone. And lots of things were measured, including in this case wrinkles. You have these pictures of people who are in the 80s, and then you look at them and they look like they're 40 or 50, and they keep getting the growth hormone injection and their face keeps changing. And so this became a very controversial study, because obviously people wanted to start using growth hormone, and the FDA had its own precautions about this because not much was known. And surely, as these people continued to receive growth hormone, they developed other problems. Acromegaly, which is an endocrine problem, they developed diabetes, they developed congestive heart failure, something called cardiomyopathy, which is a condition of the heart. They even had an increased incidence of cancer. So growth hormone therapy, for its anti-aging effects, was discarded in the United States. But if you are from Europe, then I can tell you that there are clinics today in Switzerland and in parts of France where people still go for growth hormone rejuvenative therapy, and it's given under controlled conditions. What's my opinion about that? I think it's highly dangerous. You can probably never predict what's going to happen if you give an excessive amount of growth hormone, and it's going to probably create monsters in the future if it is continued. But because of this data, we also got interested, and my colleagues and some of us who are interested in this started measuring growth factors and growth hormone after massage. And of course, growth hormone goes up very dramatically after a massage, in adults as well as in children. In children, of course, also it grows up. If you massage your baby every day, it will grow twice as fast, given the same diet in the early formative years. Same diet, because of the secretion of growth factors and growth hormone. So I think massage has rejuvenative effects, undoubtedly, not only because of the secretion of growth hormone, but also because of the absorption of free radical scavengers, and especially if you use antioxidants in the massage oil, if you use herbal supplements in the massage oil, there's a huge amount of transdermal absorption which affects not only growth hormone levels but the antioxidant effects. So therefore, there's another strategy to aging, anti-aging, and that is nutritional supplements. What are the nutritional supplements that definitely alter biological markers of aging? Antioxidants. The research is on antioxidants. So vitamin C, A, E are antioxidants. And they definitely affect the biomarkers of aging. Now, we started to look at the herbal supplements in the Vedic, Ayurvedic literature. And of all of those, the one that's supposed to be the most effective is Amlaki, the Indian gooseberry, Embelia myrabolum. This is the most powerful antioxidant known, more than any vitamin C that you can take, because it comes in a very special way, packaged by Mother Nature. The receptors in the body recognize it, and the way it's made is with ghee, which is clarified butter. And you would say, my God, clarified butter, what's that going to do to my cholesterol? Well, first of all, there's very little of it. Secondly, it turns out that our receptors that bind to these antioxidants in the body are lipid receptors, which means they're made of little molecules of fat. So actually, the clarified butter, which is used to prepare this biochavan, it helps the absorption of this nutrient. There are many good studies worldwide on the effects of this antioxidant effect, anti-carcinogenic effects, anti-arthritic effects, and basically rejuvenative effects. So if I was to summarize all the strategies for aging, I would say they are as follows, the ones that I mentioned. Change your expectation about aging. Get enough exercise to really make a difference in your muscle mass, in your muscle strength, in your bone density. And you have to go about doing that gradually, but really put attention on increasing muscle mass, bone density, and muscle strength. Everything else will be taken care of if you do that. Third, meditate every day, regularly, consistently. Once a day is not good enough. It's like, you know, taking one aspirin, it doesn't get rid of the headache. You have to take two. And you don't need to take three, you might get an ulcer. So you don't need to meditate more than twice a day also. You don't want to feel like a zombie. Just the right dose. And fourth, take nutritional supplements, either herbal or other antioxidants. Now, recently there's a whole body of literature on DHEA as a supplement. And there's a whole body of literature that's saying that DHEA, in fact, alters biological aging. There's some literature that is emerging on melatonin. And all I can say to you is it looks good. But I can't say that the scientific data at the moment says definitely this is going to work. Now, just want to say, how about the spiritual insight into all this? The mental attitude. And I think the mental techniques that influence aging are here. Changing your internal reference point from ego-based to spirit-based. Because time is manufactured and metabolized by the ego. The ego creates time. When ego entered our evolution, then death also entered our consciousness. So only the ego is that which dies. The spirit is the underlying ground beyond that. Present moment awareness is the state of awareness that creates the least amount of entropy in the physical body. Uncertainty as part of the overall order of things, or what we call the wisdom of uncertainty, which is, I accept that as my anchor, to be comfortable with uncertainty, because certainty is the prison of the past. It's the stale repetition of outworn ideas in the past. An attitude that change is the only constant and is infused with non-change, because in the midst of change, there's always the non-change of the observer. And that little exercise that we did in the midst of observation, turning back to the observer and experiencing the observer as the non-changing factor in the midst of time-bound change. The observer is the timeless factor in the midst of time-bound change. And the knowledge that entropy is a function in the universe, but it holds no threat if it is under the control of the infinite organizing power of spirit. Again, changing your reference point back to spirit all the time. So a few years ago, with all that, I came about with these ideas that I want you to go home with, which in a way capture the essence of all the Ayurvedic techniques that you've learned this week. First, listening to the body's wisdom. The body sends out only two signals. Signal of comfort and a signal of discomfort. So all behavior should be such that it, in a sense, always creates that experience of comfort. I'm not talking now about physical intense exercise, which is a part of the routine. I'm talking about generally the behaviors that create emotional comfort more than anything else. Listening to the body's emotions means listening to the wisdom of the body. Maintaining life-centered present moment awareness. This moment is as it should be. The past is gone, the future is not here. At this moment, I'm free of both. That notion that this is the only moment that really is. The past is an imagination. The future is also an imagination. The only reality is this moment. The experience of silence. We've talked about that. Relinquishing the need for approval and control. The need for approval and control are ego-based needs that are based on fear And all motivation based on fear creates entropy. Practicing defenselessness, which means relinquishing the need to defend a point of view. It doesn't mean that you don't have a point of view, it just means you don't have the need to defend it anymore. It's part of the law of least effort. Do less and accomplish more, because 99.9% of our energy is expended in proving that we are right, in defending our need to be right. So give up being right, totally and completely. That's what defenselessness is. Now, I had the good fortune to speak on this a few years ago at Mr. Gorbachev's World Forum in San Francisco. I spent the whole evening talking about the law of least effort. At the end of the talk, Mr. Gorbachev came to me and he said, "You know, I understand this principle very well. I practiced it on Mr. Bush a few years ago." So I said, "What happened?" He said, "At the height of the Cold War, during a summit, I went to him and I said, 'George, I'm going to do something terrible to you.'" And he said, Bush sort of was alarmed. He said, "What are you going to do?" He said, "I'm going to deprive you of an enemy. I'm going to deprive you of an enemy. We are going to become defenseless." And he says, "We did that. Now they pay all our bills." The law of least effort. So, relinquishing the need for approval, practicing defenselessness, using the mirror of relationship. The mirror of relationship, which means every relationship is a mirror. Those that we love and those that we hate are both mirrors of the self. We are attracted to those people in whom we find traits that we want in ourselves. And we are repelled by those people in whom we find traits that we deny in ourselves. So just to ask yourself this question: why am I attracted to this person? What is it they have that I want in myself? Can I keep borrowing these traits, or should I become these traits? And also, what's repelling me? What am I denying in my own self? Using the mirror of relationship for conscious evolution allows us to shed the burden of judgment, because you can't do it otherwise consciously. Eliminating toxins from our life. And that includes eliminating toxic people from our life. Toxic relationships, toxic emotions, toxic food, toxic chemicals, they all have the same effect. They create toxins in the body. Now we can even measure these toxins, all these hydrogen peroxide and singlet oxygen and all the things that go along in the name of radicals, hydroxy radical and so on. Replacing fear-based behavior with love-based behavior, that means internal points of reference is shifting from ego to spirit, and a deeper understanding that only come with the evolution of consciousness, that behind the mask of matter, there is a deeper reality. And that as we explore this deeper reality, we have access to states of awareness that we never recognized we had. And these states of awareness are beyond waking, dreaming and sleeping. I mentioned them the other day as an introduction: glimpsing the soul, cosmic consciousness, refined cosmic consciousness or divine consciousness, and ultimately unity consciousness. And I'll just say a few words, because I can only say a few things. The rest is experience, and hopefully we'll share that experience as we explore the world of spirit and consciousness together in future sessions. So the fourth state, beyond dreaming, waking and sleeping, is glimpsing the soul. It's when we step into the gap. And during that experience, there is restful awareness, there's a heightened state of alertness, and there is the beginnings of the intuitive response, the non-linear, contextual, relational intelligence that orchestrates the infinite diversity of the universe. In this experience, which occurs, of course, through putting attention on the observer and through meditation, we have the first glimpse of a deeper reality. Beyond the fourth state of consciousness is the fifth state of consciousness, which is called cosmic state of consciousness, which creates, just like the fourth state, restful awareness, creates its own physiology, its own brainwave pattern, its own cardiac pattern, its own immune function, etc. The fifth state of consciousness does the same. The fifth state of consciousness is called cosmic consciousness. It is the simultaneity of local and non-local awareness at the same time, which means the attention is on the observer and the observed at the same time. It's also called an alert witnessing of the roles we play. So I'm playing the role of a speaker and author right now. I also play the role of a father, I play the role of a son, I play the role of a husband, I play the role of a doctor. I'm not the roles I'm playing. I'm the alert witness of the roles I'm playing. It might be my destiny to play an infinity of roles, but I'm not the roles I'm playing. So in that alert witnessing, what happens is there's a state of awareness where there is the non-judgmental awareness of waking, dreaming and sleeping. Dreams are lucid because there's a part of you who's watching the dream. Even deep sleep has a part of you that's fully awake to the physiology of deep sleep, body and mind and brain function. Activity, there's a part of you that's caught up in activity and there's a part of you that's totally detached, which is what the spiritual traditions say, to be in this world and not of it. That's local and non-local awareness at the same time. Now in this state, if somebody were to measure your brain waves would show the same physiology as in deep meditation, even if you were playing tennis. So it's a very interesting physiological functioning that correlates with cosmic consciousness. You're in the midst of dynamic activity, but your silent observer is not overshadowed by the observation. And your physiology reflects that. Your brain waves reflect that. Your cardiac coherence reflects that. The electromagnetic fields around your body reflect that. That's cosmic consciousness. Here what happens is, we go beyond the intuitive response into the creative response, because in fact what we start experiencing more and more are coincidences and improbabilities, the conspiracy of improbabilities. The conspiracy of improbabilities that starts to weave a meaningful incident in our lives. And that's what good luck is. It's opportunity meeting preparedness. The sixth state of consciousness, which is beyond cosmic consciousness, can also call refined cosmic consciousness, is to have the experience of the observer in the observed, which means I'm looking at this flower and I'm now, you know, it's not something that you make a mood of. This is something that happens with the evolution of consciousness. Anybody can make a mood of anything. That's one of the problems with all spiritual disciplines. You don't know if somebody is lying or telling the truth. Only you know. Only you know. And if you know, then you don't even feel the need to tell anybody about it. So the sixth state of consciousness is to see the object of your observation both in its local and in its non-local nature. As I'm looking at the flower, I see the flower, but you also see the rainbow and the sunshine and the earth and the water and the wind and the void of space and the vast history of creation that brought this to where it is right now. That's going beyond the mere appearance into the underlying reality. And when you go beyond even that, then you see and cognize the same spirit. That's the sixth state of consciousness, where meaningful coincidence and synchronicity accelerates to the point where everything seems to be miraculous, because that's the experience. And finally, the state of consciousness, which is the merging of the spirit within with the merging of the spirit over there, where suddenly, because the ego is no longer the internal reference point, the environment begins to be experienced as your extended physical body. So there is the experience in awareness that the environment is not separate from me. It's my physical body. The earth is actually my physical body, and the trees are actually my lungs. Now, intellectually, that's actually true, because we're recycling the dust that makes us with the dust out there. We're recycled dirt, basically. We're recycling that. So intellectually, that's okay to know that. But I'm not talking intellectually. I'm talking about experientially, to look at the earth and the trees and experience them as my own physical being. So what Rumi says in one of his poems says, "Let the waters settle and you will see stars and moon mirrored in your being." It's a state of awareness which goes beyond the miraculous, because in fact everything is a miracle. So that's the course of evolution, metabiological evolution, beyond biological evolution, that hopefully we're all going to collectively together explore as the years unroll, since we're going to have the wisdom of aging with the biology of youth. And if there's only one word that I can use to express all that, it would be the experience of love, not as a sentiment, not as an emotion, but as the ultimate truth at the heart of creation, the experiential knowledge of unity consciousness. So I'd like to end this week's seminar with a quote from Rumi. He said, "The most important thing you can do is to become a passionate lover of life. And if you're a lover in life, then you'll be a lover in death, a lover in the tomb, a lover on the day of resurrection, a lover in paradise, and a lover forever. And if you're not a lover, then don't count your life as having been lived." Thank you very much.